So last class we started talking about the constraint equations and how in order to solve them we wanted to sort of divide our metric degrees of freedom corresponding to the spatial tensor and the extensive curvature into some degrees of freedom they specify the free data, and then some degrees of freedom which we're going to solve the constraint equations for, and we're basically wanted to do that division and end up with some nice elliptic equations which are that encapsulate our constraint equations, and we were doing that using the conformal rescaling. So I just wrote this same formula for conformal rescaling and how the Christoffel symbols calculated with respect to some usual metric and some conformally rescaled metric differ, because we're going to use that. So, and we were starting to decompose the extrinsic curvature and the momentum constraint equation last time, so we'll finish that today. So far we had written the extrinsic curvature in terms of a trace-free part Aij, and then the trace, and we said that we're going to choose the trace as free data, but we still need to choose a few more degrees of freedom. And then I think the last thing I said was that we were going to conformally rescale this Aij into this A hat with this mysterious power of psi to the 10. So we'll see where that comes from in just a second. So, all right, so we want to write down this term that appears in the momentum constraint in terms of these new variables here. And then we want to change to we want to switch out this covariant derivative for the conformally rescaled one. So we'll use this formula here. So then if we use this with n equals 3 and crunch through that, we get the following. And actually, this last term I can just set to 0. Do you know why?
Trace-free.
Yeah, trace-free. So if it's trace-free with respect to the metric, it's still going to be trace-free with respect to the conformally rescaled one. So that's 0. So then I can rewrite this way. And then, because I've cleverly chosen this factor of 10 here, that's just a hat. Okay, so this is kind of the main piece of our constraint equation. So far, let's look at what our constraint equation looks like. Our momentum constraint in particular. Okay, so we're getting closer, but we don't quite have this in the form of some like vector Laplace equation, which is what we want. And we haven't quite chosen enough free data, so we still have more. We still have some of these degrees of freedom and a hat to choose. So we're going to further decompose a hat in the following way. Yeah, so this is going to need some explanation. So first of all, I'm going to call this the longitudinal part. And this is going to, this TT stands for transverse and trace free. And so what I mean by that is that if we take the basically the divergence, but with respect to the conformal covariate derivative, then we get zero. And then of course the trace-free part just means this is also zero as well. And yeah, so and since this is trace free and this is trace free, this will be trace free as well. Right. And so I haven't actually told you what this symbol stands for. So this is actually called the conformal Killing operator, and it's defined the following way. And here X is a vector, a spatial vector. So you can see it's, it's kind of like the usual Killing equation terms, but with this conformal part instead of the plane covariant derivative. But then I've also subtracted out the trace, right? So then this is, as I was claiming, this is manifestly trace-free. And you can also see it's symmetric. Just because if we switch indices, these just switch. Right, and so basically, like the fact that I can actually do this decomposition is just a general mathematical fact that will hold in asymptotically flat spacetimes. So you can see Appendix B of those Gourgagnon lecture notes for some more details. But basically, this is just like a generalization of Helmholtz theorem. So might be familiar with the fact that if we have some vector field under some conditions that it dies off sufficiently far away, we can write it as the divergence of some term plus, so we can write it as a gradient of a scalar plus some curl. And so the curl part, I mean, obviously will have zero divergence, just like this part is has zero divergence. So this is basically the generalization of this to tensors. So we're now in the position to define the conformal vector Laplacian, which I'm going to write with this delta tilde with an L. It's basically just taking the, you know, some divergence of this conformal Killing operator, and basically, because of this property here, that means when I apply this to a hat, then this part goes to zero, and I just get this. Any questions about that? Okay, and so now we're basically ready to write down the final form of our constraint equations in this conformal transverse traceless decomposition. So I basically wrote down the Hamiltonian constraint last time, but wrote it down in a slightly different form using these further decompositions we made. So that's the Hamiltonian constraint. Here's the momentum constraint. Okay, so you know, here we have a nice basically Laplace-like equation on our with respect to our conformal metric equation for this conformal factor psi. Here, by square, I just mean contract this with itself. And one thing that you will notice is that instead of writing the energy density, I wrote energy density tilde. So we'll get to how to scale the matter in just a second. But then for the momentum constraint, we now have this basically vector Laplace type equation. And so we can solve this for this vector field X. So we have basically one vector equation that determines it. And again, it has this nice elliptic form. And here, these like scalenes introduced were, I just left them general for now. So E tilde is some power n of the energy density, and the conformal momentum density is some power m of the momentum density. And now we're going to make some arguments about sort of the best powers to choose for this to get some nice properties for our equations. You could just make these equal to each other, set these to zero, but you wouldn't necessarily get the desired property for your equations. So one thing to sort of notice immediately is if we look at this momentum constraint, right? If we make a, so we said that K, the trace of the extensor curvature, is free data, right? So one nice choice for that would be to set this to some constant. That's actually a common choice called choosing slices of a constant mean curvature. So if we choose constant mean curvature conditions, this term goes away. And our only dependence on this conformal factor psi is this term right here, right? So right now, these in general, these two equations are coupled together, right? We have to solve them simultaneously because they both involve psi and x, right? But if we choose constant k, we can set this to zero, and then if we choose m equals 10, this term will go away. This term will go away as well. So for that reason, that's a rather common choice. Yeah, and by the way, just some more terminology. If you have the special case where k is not only constant but equal to zero, that's known as maximal slicing. Okay, so now we're gonna think a little bit about this best choice for n here. And we're actually gonna choose that based on uniqueness considerations. So let's consider that we have some, or and just sorry to go back to here. With this choice, we can basically solve this equation by itself for x, get some solution. Then we have to plug it back in here, and then we can solve this one. But it makes things a bit easier. Let's consider uniqueness. And so say we have some solution say we have some solution, call it psi bar, that satisfies this equation, the Hamiltonian constraint. And then we want to basically see if there's another solution that's nearby it. So that is psi bar plus some small perturbation, but this is some function of the spatial coordinates. So this is not like we're basically considering a local uniqueness if there's another nearby solution to the one we found. So we could basically just plug this into this equation and use the fact that psi bar is a solution to the equation, and also use the fact that we only are interested in keeping terms that are linear and epsilon. And when we do that, we get the following. So we get this, when we drop all the nonlinear terms, we get this linear equation for epsilon. And I'm going to call this whole thing in brackets C. So then we can use the maximum principle to basically argue for so you know, if this constant C is, or it's not a constant, but if this function C is greater than or equal to zero, then we can apply the maximum principle, which perhaps you've seen in like an introductory PDEs class, to argue that you know, if we are solving this equation for epsilon with some boundary conditions, then epsilon has to attain its maximum on the boundary. So in particular, if we choose boundary conditions for psi that are the same as psi bar, that means the boundary condition for epsilon is that it's zero. So that means that the maximum of epsilon has to be zero. And then we can also apply the same reasoning to minus epsilon, because we get the same equation basically. And from that we can argue that the minimum and maximum of epsilon has to be zero, and therefore epsilon has to be zero everywhere in the domain. But you know, you'll notice that you know, this C isn't guaranteed to be positive, right? I mean, some of these terms we basically can control by setting the free data. But let's say we have some energy here; we want that to be positive, right? But if we kind of choose this conformal scaling the wrong way, like if we just set it to zero, this would actually give a negative contribution to C. So for that reason, we typically, you know, basically want to choose n greater than or equal to 5, so that the energy density basically won't be able to spoil this this local uniqueness. Uh, So we can certainly choose it higher than 5. One nice choice is actually n equals 8. So I'll show you why that's a good choice in just a second. But any questions about that? Yeah, so a motivation for choosing n equals 8 is actually so we can basically preserve energy conditions. In particular, what's known as the dominant energy condition. So that basically states if we take the stress energy tensor, and then we contract it with some vector t, and this is some future pointing causal vector, which just means it's either time-like or null. Then this should be, or basically this, that should be, without the minus sign, it should be positive greater than or equal to 0, or written with this minus sign, we have this way. And if we, in particular, write this in terms of the unit normal to our slices of constant time, we can rewrite this in the 3 plus 1 language. So basically, the dominant energy condition says that the kind of momentum shouldn't be too large compared to the energy density associated. Because in some sense, if it were, you would kind of think of it as moving faster than the speed of light. But the point is, with this way of doing things, we don't get to specify what E and P is, right? We're only specifying what E tilde and P tilde is. So in principle, we could, you know, guess some conformal versions of these equations that would satisfy this inequality. But then once we solve for the conformal factor, we can no longer satisfy the energy condition. But if we choose n equals 8, basically, we don't have that problem. So we can see that the following way. So if we choose the conformal quantities to satisfy this inequality with respect to the conformal vector, sorry, conformal metric, then just using this n equals 8 scaling, we get e squared is psi to the minus 16 e tilde squared. And then that should be greater than or equal to this by this. But then we can just rewrite that in terms of the non-rescale quantities, right? So we get you know, a 4 there, and then we get by our choice, yeah. So we multiply 4 here, and then minus 10 to each of these, right? And those all cancel out. So then we have non-conformally rescaled variables. So basically, if we our free data satisfies this inequality, then once we solve for the conformal factor, it still will. Okay, so just want to quickly recap the conformal transverse traceless equations, and then we'll look at an example. But were there questions about that?
Yeah. In GR required to have a diffeomorphism and symmetry, right? Then you have a solution, then you act on a diffeomorphism, it is also a solution, but here why it is unique?
So basically what we're saying is if you specify all the free data and some boundary conditions for like these variables.
You also need to gain choice, right?
Oh, well, in some sense, we've already chosen. Well, right now, we're just solving for initial data on some time slice. So we've kind of, in some sense, already chosen the time slice, right? So we don't have that. And then of course, like you could choose different spatial coordinates, right? But in some sense, you know, by choosing, the conformal metric and so forth, you're choosing some of those degrees of freedom already.
So the choice, a gauge and visual media.
Yeah, basically. Maybe we can recap all the free data and the degrees of freedom, and then we can come back to your question if you still have it. All right, so the free data that we've chosen is the conformal spatial metric, the trace of the extrinsic curvature, this gamma hat ij, the transverse trace is part of it. The conformal energy density, and the conformal momentum density. So in some sense, we've already chosen something about what our spatial metric looks like, about the hypersurface, whether it's like a maximal slice or not. We can kind of roughly think of this as kind of the gravitational wave degrees of freedom, because it's kind of like this is roughly going to correspond to some time dependence of the metric and in particular the transverse traceless part. So that's not exact or anything, but roughly you can think about it that. And then this is choosing your matter content.
There's also a psi, right?
So this is the free data, and then the constrained data is what we solve for. So we don't get to choose psi, right? We just solve this equation to get it. And then again, we don't get to choose xi. We just solve this equation to get it. Yeah. Right, and just to check, so, initially we said we had, what we want to specify is gamma ij and kij, and we said we had 6 degrees of freedom here and 6 degrees of freedom here because they're symmetric. So that's a total of 12. So we can check the degrees of freedom we have. So how many degrees of freedom do we have here?
Six.
It's almost six, but we can always rescale it, right, by some conformal factor. So in that way, it kind of loses 1 degree of freedom. And then here, how many do we have? Yeah, just one here. And this one.
There's a trace free condition.
Trace free. Yeah, so we start with six, because, and then we take away one because it's trace free. So that's five. And then we have the other T, which is transverse, right? So that basically takes away another three, right? Because it's a...
That is also tagged by the sign, right? Tagged by the conformal transformation.
Uh-huh. Well, we already counted that here. But yes, we have two here. So that gives us eight. And then here we have one and then three. So that's four. So indeed, we basically divided these 12 degrees of freedom into these four constrained ones in the eight free data.
Can you explain again why the ATTIJ only has two freedoms?
Okay. Right, so.
Transfer is efficient in the TT.
Yeah, so like here we have six, and then we divide it into like five plus one, right?
TT has three conditions in process.
Huh?
TT has three conditions imposed on AIJTT.
Right? Yeah, because this J is free, right?
All right.
Okay. Yeah. So basically, start with six, do five plus one, and then here we start with five, and then we do three plus two, right? Yeah. And then this only has two because I guess naively six, but then trace takes away one, and then this condition takes away three. Okay, and you know, once we solve for these, we can basically compute everything we need, right? Just to remind you, so gamma ij is given by this. Kij is the trace part. Transverse traceless part, and then this part we solve for, and then we can also calculate our matter with these rescalings we wrote down. Okay. Yeah. So. But yeah, I mean, you can kind of see how, yeah, we've definitely used up all our degrees of freedom this way. You know, in some sense, you have coordinate transformations, like spatial ones, on the slice, but you've kind of, you know, specified them in some sense by, like, choosing this free data. Yeah, so any questions about that before we go to example? Okay, so, yeah.
The moment constraint on the upper level, the moment constraint.
Uh-huh.
The moment constraint.
Yeah.
With this equation involved is A, I, J, and K. So why?
Did I write this wrong or something?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's maybe not there.
So why in this equation? The A, I, J, and K are not called constraint data.
Sorry, say again?
Because I say that in the next equation. That's you call the psi and the x are the constraint data.
Right.
But there's also a moment constraint for the aij and the ky.
Well, this is just this, like I rewrote this equation as this equation using this decomposition. So it is the same equation.
Okay.
But basically, like in this form, I mean, we just have three equations, right? We have three equations, but like as we just argued before, there's kind of 5 degrees of freedom here, right? So it doesn't fully specify it. So we have to still specify some parts of Aij. Yeah, but this is our new momentum constraint in the CTT formalism. Okay, so let's do a simple example. So let's just choose vacuum. So the energy and momentum density is zero. We'll choose this maximal slicing, which means k equals zero. And we'll also choose our initial data to be quote unquote waveless, which is setting this ATT component to zero. And then for our metric, we'll set it to be conformally flat. So the conformal metric is just the flat metric. And then for boundary conditions, we just want this conformal factor to go to 1 at infinity, and this spatial vector x to go to 0. So in this case, our equations simplify a lot. So momentum constraint is the following. And the momentum constraint is just this. So we can solve this one first. I mean, there's an obvious solution, right? Which is just x equals, so first, if we just consider our domain to be, all of R3, then the solution is pretty simple, right? We just get x equals zero everywhere. We plug that in, this term goes to zero, so then we just get the Laplace equation with no source. And psi goes to 1 at infinity, so then psi is 1 everywhere. And then we just get flat space, right? So that's good. Flat space should be a solution for the constraint equations. But that's perhaps a little bit too simple. So let's do something slightly different, where instead of taking our domain to be all of R3, we're going to basically remove a ball of radius R from the center of it and then impose some inner boundary conditions as well. So R3 with a ball of radius R removed, And then, so then we need some boundary conditions there. So we're going to choose the following. We're going to require that the divergence of the unit normal on this ball at r equals big R be zero, which means it's a minimal surface, or its mean curvature vanishes. And if we rewrite that in terms of conformal variables, we get the following. Or just use the fact that this is a sphere of constant radius r, we can rewrite that in terms of just the r derivatives. So if I just write that out a little bit, again, this one is trivial. We just get x is zero everywhere. So we again just have the Laplace equation with no source, but now in addition to this boundary condition affinity, they go to one. We need to satisfy this inner one. And you know, it's easy to check that the sort of unique solution of that is just for psi equals 1 plus big R over R. So yeah, it dies off at infinity, just goes to 1. And then if we evaluate this equation here at big R, we also get this equals 0. And if we basically use this conformal factor, the solution we get you might recognize as just it's just a Schwarzschild and what are called isotropic coordinates. Isotropic because you know, the metric is flat with this conformal factor in front. And here I've basically defined M to be 2R. So the coordinate radius of the black hole horizon in these coordinates is actually m over 2. Okay, so any questions about that? So this conformal transverse traceless way of decomposing the constraint equations is one, but it's really not the only or unique way to do this. So I just want to briefly mentioned some other variations on that without going through the derivations. And then I'll make a couple of remarks in general about how one actually chooses this free data for kind of, you know, interesting, studying interesting physical systems. A variation on this CTT is what's called the conformal thin sandwich. Or CTS. And that's similar. And you choose the conformal spatial metric, trace of the extrinsic curvature. So this is the free data. But you, in this case, you choose the conformal lapse as well. And the time derivative of the, at least the traceless part of the conformal metric. And then you again solve for some conformal factor psi, but the vector you solve for is actually just the shift factor instead of this xi. And it's kind of called the thin sandwich because you're kind of choosing gamma ij not only in your slice, but since you're choosing this time derivative, you're choosing it kind of around the slice. So they call that the thin sandwich. And there's a extension of this, the extended conformal thin sandwich. Which is similar. Except basically, instead of choosing the lapse, you choose the time derivative of the extrinsic curvature, and then you'll solve for the lapse. But you actually get an extra equation that you have to solve for that. Yeah, and that's useful in a lot of situations because a lot of times kind of what you know about your solution is that, you know, in some sense you want it to be in like stationary or equilibrium or something. At least approximately in a particular frame. So in that case, you know, you would set this to zero or something like that. And then you can just solve for the lapse, whereas, you know, choosing the lapse itself might be a little bit more kind of unintuitive what the physical implication of that is. Yeah, so just to make a couple of remarks on how you choose this free data. So one strategy is to kind of use superposition, right? So the idea is let's set our conformal metric, like let's say we have a binary system. We want to study like what happens when one black hole collides with another black hole, or what happens when two neutron stars orbit each other. So, you know, we have exact solutions that describe, for example, isolated black holes or isolated stars. But we usually need to solve these elliptic equations to come up with solutions that solve that are binaries that have initial data that describe binaries. So one idea is, okay, let's just if these two objects are kind of sufficiently far apart, you could at least in Newtonian gravity, you could just add the solutions together, right? So you could say, this is the spatial metric of a black hole with some given mass and spin boosted in this direction, and this is one with a black hole and spin, black hole, some mass and spin boosted in that direction. Add those two together, subtract flat space, and we'll set that to be our conformal metric. And same thing for the other quantities. And of course, GR is a nonlinear theory, so that's not going to solve the constraints with, conformal factor equals one everywhere. But hopefully, if that's kind of a good guess, you'll get something like the conformal factor is kind of close to one with some small rescaling such that you actually do satisfy the constraint equations. And that sort of captures the nonlinear part that you didn't know. One system that's of particular interest for gravitational wave sources are what are called quasi-circular binaries. That's binaries where the objects are basically going around in a circular orbit, and then of course it's quasi-circular because they're emitting gravitational radiation, so the orbit is actually changing, it's shrinking with time. But it kind of in the regime where this radiation reaction isn't too strong, that's kind of a small correction to the circular orbit. And something I think you actually worked out in one of the later tutorials is that gravitational radiation actually drives binaries to be in quasi-circular orbits. Even if they start with some orbital eccentricity, gravitational radiation will actually want to drive them towards the circular orbit. So for that reason, so far all the gravitational wave observations we made have been consistent with the binaries being in this quasi-circular orbit, at least for the number of cycles that we see before they merge. So that doesn't have to be the case for all astrophysical systems, but that definitely makes quasi-circular binaries a particularly interesting one. An assumption you can make there is that, so if it were kind of exactly circular, you would have what's called a helical Killing vector. So that's a Killing vector that's basically says that as you move forward in time, you just rotate your system with some orbital velocity, and then you get back the same system. So basically, because these things are in a quasi-circular orbit, if you kind of move forward in time and rotate a little bit, you get back the same system. Again, this is an approximation, but you can use it to set your free data and then solve for the corrections using the elliptic equations. And so, a usual assumption is to assume that with respect to this helical Killing vector, your metric is approximately, so this is an approximate symmetry of your system. And you can basically use this to, set these time derivatives in the co-rotating frame to be zero. And then in addition to that, you might want to impose some matter conditions that basically say your matter is in equilibrium. So I think you did the tutorial solving for these two V stars, right? And so that case, you basically assume that your matter is at rest as well. It is in equilibrium. And that will give you some additional equations in some case, which you would want to solve in conjunction with the constraint equations. So I think I'm out of time here. So any questions about that? Okay. Yeah, next class we'll talk about well-posed evolutionary equations for GR, in particular the generalized harmonic formulation.